Good morning. This is September 20th, and we are beginning with a Virgi Eye. Today, on week 5, this is 2050. Okay. Now you have a little review of the GI track, right? Good. So you kind of know what we're talking about. Let's see. Okay. So let's begin with nice and simple: nausea and vomiting. We see a lot of that in the hospital, don't we? Real fun stuff. So nausea. What's it caused by? I'm sorry? Yeah, just a nausea. We don't even have to be that exact. Right. It's a brain reflex, isn't it? It causes the cause of nausea, and that can be triggered by what?
Smells and sights.
Smells and sights and some pathologic conditions, such as what? What?
Pain?
Sure, yeah. Anybody ever vomited from pain? That is not fun. Have we got nausea? Mm-hmm. Yeah, what else?
Brain tumor,
sure. Pushing on that sensor, you bet ya. Absolutely. What else?
Illness
such as? How about a gastritis?
Yeah.
Right, that sounds good, doesn't it? Sure, some intestinal bug you have, yeah. That sounds good, what else?
Pregnancy.
Yeah, hormonal imbalances affecting that area of the brain, yep. Or that the GI that's affecting the brain. Yeah.
Inner ear,
right? Sure. Absolutely. Yes. Equilibrium problems.
Obstruction.
An obstruction. A GI obstruction. Good. How about motion sickness? Yeah. A lot of things cause nausea and vomiting. Very common gastrointestinal symptoms. So not, and you're right, the medulla. Absolutely correct. Of the brain is stimulated, okay? And we talked about all the different sources. Vomiting, so what's vomiting? That's nausea. What does vomiting require? Vomiting is actually kind of a complex deal. It's vomiting. It's coordinated by the brain stim, and it requires synchronized movements of the thorax, the abdominal wall, the gut, the pharynx, and the muscles of the mouth and face. So think about vomiting. It's kind of complex, right? You're going to see a lot of it in your travels, isn't this? In the mouth, we find stomatitis. What's stomatitis? That's kind of a weird word, right? You didn't necessarily equate it with the mouth, but it makes sense because the mouth is an orifice. Stomatitis. Inflammation of the lining of the mouth. Infection, mechanical trauma, irritants such as alcohol, hypersensitivity. I had pineapple the other day and had my tunnel doing weird. A little bit of inflammation from the pineapple enzymes, okay? Anything as simple as that, or as complex as chemotherapy, okay? The lining of the mouth is very thin, very fragile, very vascular. So that's common. Inflammation and ulcers of the oral mucosa. There are many different kinds of lesions. How about GERD? Any familiarity with GERD? Gastropharyngeal reflex disease. Anybody have it? Had it? Parents have it? You may. Many of your patients will have it.
Yeah.
Did they? Oh, good. Tell us it. Please, tell us about it. Any of you. All of you. What is it? You looked it up? You looked it up. Right? All right, you're ready.
Well, it's dangerous because of all the stomach acids that can lead to aspiration.
Yeah, it's dangerous because of that. What's the physio of it? Remember? What's the physio of GERD? Remember
the sphincter, the muscles behind the sphincter, so it kind of
Yeah, that sphincter between the esophagus and the stomach, because we can get the diaphragm. And so, yeah, exactly. You can reflex up the contents of the stomach, and yeah, it can be dangerous for aspiration. Reflex back into the esophagus from the stomach. And you're right. So what does gastric juice contain? It can be a problem. Acid, pepsin, right? Yeah, exactly. It can be corrosive. And so if this is constantly going on, what are we going to get?
Ulcers,
any kind of breakdown of the esophagus, of that tissue. Yeah. Esophagitis, actually, is what it's called. Hiatal hernias. Anybody have a patient with that in the patho? Hiatal hernia is part of the stomach protrudes through the esophageal hiatus of the diaphragm. The stomach is protruding through the diaphragm into the thoracic cavity. Okay. Thought to be pretty common. Most of the time they're asymptomatic, and the incidence increases with age, as sadly all our muscles tend to relax and our sphincters tend to relax as we age, which is not fun. Cigarette smoking, chronic alcohol use are strong risk factors. For esophageal cancer and actually
hiatal hernia as well. So there you go. This is reflex. Okay, stomach acid comes right back up, right here. This sphincter is not solid. And this is a hiatal hernia, when there's a protrusion up to the diaphragm. This is a diaphragm. Okay. So the fundus of the stomach moves up to the diaphragm and allows, again, gastric juices to flow into the lower esophagus. Yes, ma'am.
I think it's ulcers.
Yeah, we're gonna get there. I promise. Gastrointestinal bleeding.
Sometimes we get GI bleeds, and they can be very serious. Irritation to the stomach so much so that it bleeds. Nausea, vomiting. Okay. Hematoemesis, which is vomit with blood in it. Okay. So if you see that big word, you know what it is. If blood's been present in the stomach for a long time, what are they gonna vomit? What's it gonna look like? Coffee grounds, dry blood, yeah. If it's fresh, it's gonna look red, and that's very important. Coffee ground appearance rather than bright red, so that's important. Stools can be black and tarry from blood too. Bleeding in the GI tract is something that we commonly look for as nurses, and remember who did this test in the lab last summer? What did he do? I do it for cold blood, right? Hematocrits, right? Not hematocrits. What do they call the little, you know, the little test we did? Hemocults. Remember who did this? We put my little paper in the cup. What are we doing at the hospital? We tested for cold blood. Commonly tested for cold blood, and what we're looking for is it bleeds somewhere in the GI system. Somewhere.
So, peptic ulcers, here we go. This is your question regarding peptic ulcers. Can occur in any age in the GI tract exposed to acid toxin secretion, and H. pylori tends to be the cause of aging. Use of aspirin, NSAIDs, certainly compounds of protein. Yeah, so H. pylori is known to be the cause of toxic stomach ulcers. Used to be that the thought was just white men under stress who drank a lot of alcohol and had difficult jobs got stomach ulcers, right? Remember? Mm-hmm. Yes, that's because who did they do the research on? Middle-aged white men who drank a lot. Yeah. Yeah. And now it's not necessarily the case. You only get stomach ulcers, also you to get stomach ulcers, and it's because of the H. pylori. Zoland or Ellison syndrome is peptic ulcer disease caused by a gastroma, okay, or a tumor secreting. Okay, a gastrin can gasping, secreting too much of the pancreas, stomach, intestines. But more commonly, you're going to see an ulcer that's caused by H. pylori. And the acronym for that is PUD, if you see it. Peptic ulcer disease. And there are stomach cancer, adenomas of the stomach. We kind of touched on that last time we met. All right, so what have we got here? Pelvic ulcer, peptic ulcer disease. And I think this is a diagram from your text. Take a closer look about how the ulcer invades the tissue and actually kind of eats through it, causing a great deal of pain, obviously, right? If the ulcer perforates the part of the GI tract, it's in the esophagus or the bowel, then it can be very problematic because you can have a GI bleed. But hopefully we catch ulcers where they get that far. We treat them with antibiotics, we amend diets. So take a look at that in your text. It's kind of good, kind of cool. Talk about the inflammatory process. And here's nice erosion happening, see? As it erodes down through the layers. Hopefully it's not going to get that far, the treatment today, but they tend to. Because people still think that they're caused by stress and they need to drink milk, which is not the case. Again, a good opportunity for you to teach. Here's an example of some cancer in the stomach. All right, you're going to see quite a few different tests as you travel through the hospitals. A ovarian swallow test is used to identify irregular mucosal patterns or narrowing of the lumen. So you basically fill the whole GI tract with barium and take a picture of the neck. And then you can see if there's narrowing, if there's a blockage, right, of the lumen in any part of the GI tract. Esophageal cancer can be diagnosed this way. It's kind of an interesting test. One thing you should know is that barium is this white milky stuff to swallow. It goes right through the GI tract, so what do you see in the toilet at the end? White, which is a little disconcerting to the patient. And it's always nice to warn them. If they have no pair of barium swallow, but that's a good thing to do because it doesn't get digested. Which is the whole idea, because you want to photograph it and see the structure of the GI tract. Pharyngioscopy allows direct visualization of the tumor, and we can obtain tissue biopsies through that. The upper endoscopy is when they actually just put a camera down the upper GI tract and visually look. And ulcers, corrosions, look at any lesions.
We talked about intestinal bleeding, black or tarry stools. We talked about, complete blood count, obviously a CBC. Sometimes we have to do a blood type and cross match. We do give blood if people are bleeding out. We're going to check serum electrolytes, osmolality. Okay, blood uremic nitrogen, liver function studies, coagulation. Okay, upper GI. Okay. Pelvic ulcer disease, pain, heartburn, regurgitation, older adults. Okay, H. pylori, talked about this. How about gastritis? You've all probably been a little bit familiar with gastritis, right? Is there anybody who hasn't had gastritis? It's simply an inflammation of the tummy. Very simple. Chronic gastritis is often asymptomatic. We talked about this before, that we have lots of infections going on in our bodies that our bodies are fighting. They're doing a great job of it. Gastrointestinal infections are extremely common. It's only when you're immune suppressed or it's such such a forceful invasion that you get sick, such as food poisoning. Gastritis is often symptomatic. Patient might complain of vague gastric distress. You know this yourself. and epigastric heaviness after meals, ulcer-like symptoms. Okay. So we see a lot of nausea and vomiting, just a lot. Usually it requires no treatment. In the hospital, we have lots of antiemetics that we use to inhibit nausea and vomiting. Has anybody done their workup for the meds and can name a couple antiemetics? Do you remember? Name any antiemetics that you had on your sheet from last week?
Ginger.
Ginger is, yes. Ginger is homeopathic. That's always good. Do you have any? There's a couple common ones. I'm sorry? I'm not familiar. Zofran.
Yeah.
That's it? Okay. Zofran is a common antiemetic that we use. And you'll often see these. I'm sorry? We don't use it in the hospital for that. Yeah, but sure. Dramamine is a common antiemetic, yeah, that we would use over the counter. And actually, I've never seen it prescribed in the hospital. But honestly, why couldn't it be? Good point. I don't know why. Or maybe they do use that medication under a different name, and I'm not recognizing it in the hospital strength, you know. Zofran's real common. And often you'll see this med on the PRN med list. So because patients get nauseated a lot in the hospital, you can understand post-surgically all the stuff we're doing to them, pain, yeah. So we often have a PRN antiemetic, and please feel free to use it. And we talked about complementary and alternative medicines such as ginger, which is very good. Food initially withheld. Generally, when someone's nauseous, we do withhold food because it's just going to come right back up. What's the other thing you might want to withhold if they're nauseous, and not give orally? Meds. Absolutely, because what's going to happen if they're nauseous? Come right back up. Sometimes, like if it's many meds, we can get suppositories. We can have the doc switch it to a suppository. Or we can even give the antiemetic suppository, because it doesn't do much good to give an antiemetic when it comes right back up, does it? If you give it orally. So we can give it suppository, we can give it through the IV. So think about that when you have a nauseous patient. Do you necessarily want to give them a pill that they're going to throw up? Do you want to give them all their 9 o'clock meds? Probably not. Another problem is that makes people nauseous is what? What do you think would make people nauseous in the hospital that we do to them all the time? Well, maybe, yeah. What else?
Chemo.
Chemo, for sure. How about just giving them a ton of medications? Yeah. I thought people could bring in 9 meds and they go, oh. So, again, what would a good nursing intervention be? For that, something that's easy for you to do. But how could you? Antiemetic before, that's a very good idea, an hour before. Excellent. Know what you're giving. Like if you're giving an iron supplement, don't give it on an empty stomach. That is just cruel and asking for a lot of work for yourself. Because an hour you're going to have to be cleaning up the vomit. All right? So don't do that. What about breaking up the meds? You've got a 2-hour block. Meds are due at 9, you can start at 8 and give them all the way to 10. So you might want to break some up. Wait until after breakfast to give the iron. Okay? So yeah, think about it when you're giving medications. If they have an antiemetic, give it at 8. Give the rest of the meds at 9:30, you know? Okay? So think, again, engage your mind. Don't just give the meds. Nurses, the best nurses are going to be the ones who are thinking about these sorts of things. And they seem extremely simple and logical as we talk about it today in lecture, right? Watch how you don't see it happen on the floor. And a patient get an iron pill and they'll vomit, you know, half hour later. And the nurse says, oh, well, why are they vomiting? Well, duh. You give iron on an empty stomach. What do you expect? It's very, very caustic. And actually, in general, most meds do better with a little food. So if you have the option, if someone who has a more sensitive stomach, if you have the option, give them after breakfast, after they've had a little toast. So these are the kind of things that I want you to be thinking about. And we talked a little bit about stomatitis. And we talked about GERD, right? Normally does not require any surgery. Lifestyle changes, yeah, a little bit, right? They maybe shouldn't drink quite so much. Treatment focuses on lifestyle changes, diet modifications, and in severe cases there is drug therapy. And in very severe cases, there's even surgery. We use a lot of antacids, acid neutralizing agents in the hospital. Why do you think we treat GERD so heavily in the hospital? What would make sense? Why do you think? You have somebody my age. What am I doing when I'm in the hospital? Giving you a hint. Yeah. Are my sphincters in any part of my body as tight as yours? No. No. So even though I don't have GERD, am I likely to get in the hospital? Very likely, because I'll be lying on my back eating. What's going to happen? It's going to come right back up. So you'll see, I might even stretch it to say the majority of your patients are going to be on some kind of an antacid. We neutralize the acids in the stomach because then when they do come up, they're not caustic, right? So that's the whole concept of an antacid to fight GERD. Let's see. Medications neutralize the stomach acids. Sometimes they increase motility, which means they keep it going. And gastric emptying is what we want. So if the quicker we empty the stomach, we're not going to have food sitting there ready to regurgitate up. And your patient's going to be more comfortable. Hiatal hernias, again, generally no treatment, but symptoms, they present similar to GERD. And if they become severe, we can certainly treat them. Again, surgery is a possibility, and antacids, again, are something that's given. Yes?
I just have a random question.
Sure.
Would GERD be a precursor to an esophageal
varices? Actually, alcoholism is. So those are coupled, yes. But we see esophageal varices with alcoholism. It has to do with the blood flow and the backup and the swelling of the vessels in the esophagus. And then if it's coupled with GERD, which it commonly is, then it becomes even more of a problem. So it's, to answer your question, I would say it was a contributing factor, a cause. Generally, no, we see it from alcoholism. But would it be a contributing factor? Absolutely. To it, yes, to the already existing condition, and may increase the manifestations, surely, and make it more symptomatic, and the whole problem larger because of the GERD, yeah, and exposure to the acid, but generally not as a primary reason. I'm not saying it couldn't happen, but I've never seen it. The alcohol, the varices, which are then irritated further by the GERD. Is what I've seen in practice. Tell me if your research shows any different than what I've seen. Okay, please. Talked a little bit about GI bleed. Sometimes there's slow chronic bleeds, like from an ulcer, that can be managed. Massive bleeds are critical. People can bleed out from the GI bleed. And that can be very dangerous. So how we treat them completely depends on the severity of the bleed. Some people have old blood. They have blood in their stools. Been going on for years. Please don't make the dumb mistake that I did as a new nurse. A lady came out of the bathroom, and the toilet was, I thought, full. Obviously, you know how blood is. You drop one drop into water, and it just goes all over. Looks like everything's bloody. I thought, oh, my God, she's hemorrhaging, right? Because it was all fresh blood. What was it? It was a hemorrhoid. And the doctor said, no. I said, oh, she's hemorrhaging. The physician was in the room, and he says, she has really bad hemorrhoids. There's no problem. Okay. I felt really dumb. So if you see fresh blood, it's actually not as much of a problem because it probably is hemorrhoids. I'm certainly making a note of it, but it's not something to be as concerned about as if we're getting that old blood. It's higher up in the GI tract. Okay. Medications, discontinue NSAIDs, absolutely. Good nutrition. Again, sometimes surgery is required to stop any of these bleeds, no matter what it's from. All right. It could be from Crohn's disease. It could be from ulcerative colitis. It could be from an ulcer. Doesn't matter. It could be esophageal varices, like you were saying. Sometimes it gets bad enough that the surgery is required, but hopefully we're able to catch it before then. Talked about gastritis. Talked about something. Okay, what does a nurse do? What do we do? What we certainly do is identify patients at risk. Who's at risk for GERD? Who's your classic GERD person? What do you think? Just in logic, where would logic take you?
Middle age,
yeah, to older, right? Well, tell me more about them. They're heavier, absolutely. Yeah, more weight, more stress. Yeah, I bet you. Overweight, heavier. Mm-hmm. And older as you age, your sphincters are less. What? One other thing that would make them more susceptible to GERD. Yeah, it does. True, but that's not right. Just physiologically, what do you think?
Eating spicy
food would be more irritating. Yes, when they had it. How about their lifestyle? Their mobility. Are they up and around? Or are they lying down? If they're lying down in bed all day, they're going to be much more susceptible to GERD, which is why our patients are a problem. People that are up, mobile, they don't have as much chance for the reflex to happen. It's going to reduce their risk. So here you go. Greater than 55, impaired immune status, of course. This is for stomatitis, okay? So we got all those. Tobacco use, obviously. Poor oral hygiene. This is all for ulcers of the mouth. Risk factors for esophageal cancer, cigarette smoking, smoked opioids, that's kind of interesting. Congenital disorders. Any kind of mucosal breakdown.
Okay.
What do you say? Well, yeah, let's hope not. For PUD, peptic ulcer disease, H. pylori, all these, aspirin. Okay. A lot of use of aspirin. Tends to be corrosive. Drugs, history, smoking, family history. So we are subjective and objective data, as always. Right. Determine the cause of the complaint, and you're going to design diagnoses. So certainly, start incorporating some of these concepts into your care plans. Nausea and vomiting is a great one. Almost everybody in hospitals at risk for nausea and vomiting, aren't they? For some reason or another. How about GERD? They're all at risk for GERD too, aren't they? So here's a couple more ideas for your care plans. Make those, keep growing your maps, right? And stomatitis, yeah, for sure, right? Irritating foods. If they're cancer patient, definitely. What else? Okay, let's do a break. How would that be? And then we can do something fun. So I'll let you take a break, and I'll set up our Jeopardy. How's that sound? Let's do Jeopardy next. It looks like... Okay, we just did our Name That Urinary Tract Jeopardy, so it seems appropriate that we continue on with urine before moving on to anything else. So I'm pulling up the urinary disorders part. So why is urine so important, guys? Why are nurses so fixated on urine? Because physicians don't want to be? Why do you think?
Yeah,
quantity is important. Volume is important diagnostic tool. What else? What else can we find out from urine? Why is urine, why do we make such a big deal about urine?
Bacteria.
Sure, it's a common source of bacteria problems. What else?
Hydration, yeah. So we can tell about hydration. We can tell about their immunity status. People with decreased immunity always get UTIs. We can tell about volume. Are they hydrating? Correct? So we can tell quite a bit about urine. How do you assess urine? Right? Turbidity? Yeah? Is it cloudy? Is it clear? When do we see if it's cloudy? I mean, what conclusion do we come to this cloudy? Could be some bacterial growth, right? Yeah, we could lead to infection. Sure. If it's clear, that's good. What else? What are we assessing with color? Hydration status. Blood, excellent. Is it hematuria? Good, excellent. What else? What are we assessing when we assess volume? What did you say, output? Yeah, glomerular filtration rate. Very good. How well the kidneys are functioning. Sure, because if they're oliguric, now I get to use the big words, huh? If they're oliguric, what's that telling you? So you walk into your end-stage renal failure patient and the catheter has this gunky, pea-colored, little tiny bit of urine in it. And you think, oh my God, right? Mm-hmm. No, that's absolutely normal for that patient. Mm-hmm. Right?
Because they have, maybe they're only half the nephrons online.
They're end-stage renal failure.
Okay.
So their nephrons aren't working, exactly. Their kidneys have failed. They're on dialysis. Are we getting any urine? No. So they're anuric and uric. There's no urine. So you can tell a heck of a lot from looking at urine. How are you describing urine? Yes, by the turbidity, clear, cloudy, okay. Volume, certainly. And then you have every color in the spectrum available to you. It's wheat colored, it's pink, yellow, it's canary. I worked in the hospital, we had computerized charting with 12 different definitions for the color of urine. Yeah. But there are some specific problems with the urinary tract. Smell, excellent, good, very good. Smell, we forgot smell. Yeah, what are we going to see from smell? What are we going to see? What are we going to smell from smell? From the odor. Excellent. If it's diabetic, it's going to be sweet. What else? Yeah. Infection, you're going to get an odor to it. If there's excess ammonia, you're going to get ammonia smell. Smell like cat urine. Yeah. So yes, good. Excellent. Thank you very much. You've forgotten scent. Or hopefully not their own, not too smell. Okay, so yeah. And who's dealing with the urine? Is the physician coming in and smelling the urine? No. They very well might come in and look at the Foley, look at the color. They often do that. I don't know why, because we always write about it. But to see if there's any output. Volume is crucial. Because I know you talked last semester about hypervolemia and hypovolemia. And with drips and all, how that's, yeah, we're gauging input and output with urine volume. So if you have your patient on a drip of 150 mLs an hour, and you have a Foley in, and you're getting 50 mLs, there's a problem. So we're very, very careful to assess urine output. It is definitely charged to us. It is something the physicians do look at. It helps in their diagnosis, in their plan of care. So we need to be on it. Urine is very important. As kind of comical as that may be, urine is very much a part of medicine. And there are some complications. UTIs, right? Most commonly in women, particularly two age groups, pregnant and aged, and men over 50. Okay? It's common in young women, rare in men under the age of 50. Pregnancy increases in risk. Risk increases with age for both sexes. In the aged population, the female ratio of UTIs changes from 50 to 1 to less than 5 to 1. So in the younger, under 50, 50 to 1 women get urinary tract infections over men. After the age of 50, it's 5 to 1 You have your general class. Why is that? What's your guess? That would be one reason. Their inability to fight back their infection. Their decreased resistance. Okay, that would be one. Idea what else? Yeah, and the incontinence is caused by? Which is related to? Why do men have problems with incontinence as they age?
Prostate
problems. Absolutely. And sometimes they can't go. And then there's urinary retention, right? One other thing that I've seen in aged gentlemen, definitely, and if you have it, you will. What else? The comment was the urethra shrinks. I honestly don't know. I have not heard that. You may be right. Did they bring that up in jar? You may have. I haven't heard it, but sounds plausible. Yes.
Doesn't the pH go up as
you age? Oh, interesting. Does it? I don't know.
Yes.
You would know more. I didn't ever had a jar class. That does it, okay? pH, yeah, which would then cause you would have a kind of a bacterial growth like that pH.
Don't the nephrons decrease
too? Sure. Yeah, nephrons age just like everything else. But specific, but what else? What do you guess? This is something more basic. Why do we see the same things in men? Why is it more equal as they age? Simply hygiene, the ability to clean themselves. Mm-hmm. All right, and that's particularly true of uncircumcised men. They're the ones that, and they say uncircumcised men are more at risk for UTIs, that's not because they haven't been circumcised. That's because of their ability to clean. That's all. There's a little more coordination, okay, to pull down the torso and clean. And please, that's something that is a nursing task. I've seen just horrible infections from men that come from nursing homes with horrible UTIs and actually ulcers on the top of their penises because people haven't taken the time to thoroughly clean them. So, yeah, make sure that. Okay, so before 50, it's like 50-1. After, it's 5-1. All right. Why are women so much more susceptible? Sexual activity, all this, but why else?
Shorter
urethra. When you're doing a full day on a woman, you don't have very far to push it in, right? So how far does the bacteria have to go to reach the bladder? Not that far. On a man, sometimes it's got to get there somewhere. You know, it seems like you're just putting in all sorts of tubing. And yeah, eventually you hit the bladder. But there's a lot longer course. So men have, physiologically, are much less prone to UTIs. Okay. And there are, yeah, here we go. Short, straight urethra in women. Short and straight. And the proximity of the urinary meatus to the vagina and the anus in women. Okay, it's pretty exposed. Where the men have a much more protected urethra all the way around, right? I mean, women, it's right there. You get a vaginal infection, you know. Commonly, vaginal infections and UTIs go together, very commonly. Okay. Let's see, what else? Talked about behaviors, personal hygiene, there's congenital risk factors. Often because of abnormalities in the formation of the urethra, in the different lengths of tubes, valves, all this kind of thing, can be congenital abnormalities that are very, very common that make people more at risk. What else? We had circumcision only because of the hygiene thing. And I'm really a proponent of not circumcising infants. And I hate reading that uncircumcised men get more urinary tract infections without any explanation. It's only because they get old and can't clean themselves. This happens at the other end of the age spectrum, too, right? They say, oh, little boys get UTIs if they haven't been circumcised. Well, yes, if they're not careful about cleaning or they're not taught to be careful. And here we go with a hypertrophy of the prostate, right? Absolutely. That's a huge factor. And bacterial prostatitis. The prostate can become infected, swollen, and cause all sorts of issues. So men have all those problems. Someone mentioned obstructions.
at some point, yeah. Structural abnormalities. Innervation of the bladder. Right. There's some problem with nerves. If there's been an accident, if there's some neurological components, yeah. Bowel incontinence, sure. Radiation. There's a lot of problems post-cancer treatment with bowel and bladder. All right. Often bowel incontinence. That little man, you had him, right? He had a lot of trouble with his bowels from a previous cancer. And now he has bladder cancer. He used to have. He was cured from bladder.
Like 45 minutes or so. Yeah.
They have a lot of trouble. And most of that destruction is done because of the radiation, which helps save his life,
granted.
But again, another example of cancer survivor care that is a good place for nurses. And chronic disease. Instrumentation of the urinary tract greatly increases UTIs. We're done, right? Everything we stick up a urethra, if that's not absolutely sterile, we're putting bacteria there, aren't we? And can it be absolutely sterile? No. So this is why we're so careful about sterility when you place Foley catheters. Very, very important. So always keep that in mind, that you're actually moving into a very, very susceptible area. Chronic pyelonephritis, increased with UTIs. If they're not treated, they can move on to polynephritis, which is an infection of the kidneys. And Dr. Fink next semester is going to talk a lot about all sorts of kidney problems with you. I get the lower health, and she's going to take you on up to the kidney problems. But if we don't treat UTIs, and last semester there was a lovely little Hispanic woman who was in her late 20s, a mom and all. She had a horrible, horrible time with pyelonephritis that started with just a simple UTI that she didn't seek treatment for. I mean, she was now risking losing her kidney. So UTIs, although we think of them, especially women, we think of them as very common, simple little things, they can be extremely serious if treatment is not sought. And some of your little demented old ladies might not really be aware, which is why as nurses we need to be on it and see the signs of UTI. Yeah. No. It was asymptomatic.
Yeah.
And then everybody was real concerned, right?
Yeah.
And then it hurt.
Yeah.
And you had flank pain, right?
Oh, yes.
Which is why in your assessment you learn to assess for flank pain, correct?
Mm-hmm.
In your urinary assessment? Yeah, exactly. Because where the kidneys? Right there, right?
Yeah.
So you know exactly where your kidneys are, don't you? You can remember that pain. Yeah, and excellent point, though. Not always are you going to feel pain, but I bet your urine was cloudy. And smelly. Yeah, but what did you know to look? So, yeah, these are the kind of things that we watch for. We protect our patients. If we can catch something that's asymptomatic early, treat for it, send the urine off, great. There's no complications. And we can save a lot of pain and heartache. So it's very, very important to assess urine, as we discussed. What about urinary calculi? That's kind of interesting. The most common populations are male. Let me find my notes on this. Printed out all these notes. I'm not using them much. Calculi obstruct the flow of urine. You know that. Most common in males, white, young, middle-aged. These are kidney stones, we call them. Okay, kidney calculi that come down. There can be congenital risk. You can have a personal family history. People who get gout, which is increased uric acid, tend to get more calculi. Hyperparathyroidism, this population does too. Urinary stasis, again, if the urine is lying in the bladder, which is why we want the urine out of there, and repeated UTIs are all common occurrences that may add to the formation of stones. Dehydration, definitely. Anybody in for urinary calculi, we're going to be having them on a drip and have a lot of hydration going on because we want to just flush, keep everything flushed. But the stones do get large enough that they obstruct the urethra and can be excruciatingly painful. They can cause Immobility is another problem, and diet and hydration particularly. Males over 60, white, urban. Okay. And we talked about there are some congenital and acquired risks. I said that. Smoking, exposure to chemicals, behavioral risks. Abdominal or pelvic surgery and medications that are anticholinergic. Okay. And so if your patient's on an anticholinergic med, you might want to say they're at risk they are at risk for urinary calculi. Right? That would certainly be appropriate in your nursing diagnosis. And appropriate nursing diagnosis. So it basically obstructs the urine flow. And if it's obstructing urine flow, it can very easily lead to infection, right? All the way up. Neurogenic bladder. Spinal cord victim strokes, multiple sclerosis, central nervous system lesions, you can get a spasmatic neurogenic bladder. Okay. Flaccid neurogenic bladder, this is something that can be congenital. Again, these same problems. Chronic alcoholism or prolonged overdistension. Who would get prolonged overextension of the bladder, do you think? Yeah, that's good. Who else? Yeah, somebody who couldn't get out of bed, or how about nurses who simply don't stop to pee? Not at all uncommon among nurses. Neurogenic bladders, yeah, and also fallen bladders. So please take care of yourself when you're on the floors. And it's so easy to go, oh, I'll just do this, oh, I'll just do that. Pretty soon you've seen it's been 6 hours since you've urinated. Or it's been a whole 8-hour shift. And you go, oh, I really do have to, yeah, I guess. Right, so please be very conscious of yourselves, because yes, there are definitely ramifications of not emptying your bladder, aside from simply UTIs. Okay, incontinence. You're learning about this in Jerry, maybe, or you will, from the elderly. We see it more in the elderly in general. We see it more in females, of course. Again, why do you think it's more in females? Childbirth does what to us? Does that, but also, in doing so, what does it do? Excellent. It looses the pelvic floor. And so how do we strengthen the pelvic floor? Kegels. And all your old lady patients should be doing Kegels. All of them. Because my guess is all of them have some form of incontinence. Extremely common, whether it's urge, whether it's stress, whether it's all these names that we went through today. Extremely common. And one way to fight it, and I've talked to nurse practitioners who work with urologists who actually can cure a lot of the incontinence just from strengthening the muscles. So tell your older ladies, start doing your Kegels. It's really important. And yes, the pregnancy thing is a factor. Only because of the weakening of the muscles. There are some hormones involved when you're pregnant, but after that, it's just the weight of the baby and the pressure, okay, giving birth. So yeah, elderly. Okay, some of the pathologies of urinary tract. Bacterial colonization. We know that. We talked about that, and we talked about infection. Anytime bacteria get together in a group, they get to grow nice big families and affect us, right? If we don't have the strength to fight them off, or the antibiotics. And we talked about instrumentation, that's important. Several different kinds of UTIs, okay? And you'll go into this a little more next semester with Dr. Fink. Cystitis, that's the bladder. The bladder's inflamed, infected. What else? Acute pyelonephritis when the kidneys are infected. And chronic, sometimes people have problems that keep going on. Chronic inflammation, generally caused by renal failure. The nephrons are dying off. They're no longer functioning. Okay. Talk a little bit about calculi. They can be either in the kidneys or anywhere else in the urinary tract. So we do distinguish in the words. Let's see, what else? What else about the calculi? Well, they can be made up of all different things. They're not necessarily strictly uric acid or calcium. So you have some choices, depending on where they're forming. Okay, what else? Tumors, a little bit about urinary tumors. It's a nice schematic of the bladder with the carcinoma. Bladder cancer is not too bad in that they can remove the whole bladder and build a new one. Is that what your patient was? Did he have a new bladder? So we just had some take it out.
Yeah.
So he still had some of his bladder left,
yeah,
is there?
Sure.
Did you have it done transurethrally?
Okay.
Maybe he had it done transurethrally. That would have been very interesting. Okay. Bladder is really neat to look at in person. It looks like a deflated balloon that's kind of yellowish, just kind of deflated. It's really fascinating. I hope you all get to see some open abdominal surgeries and have the opportunity to look at it. Urinary retention, we talked a little bit about this. Weak muscles and ability to urinate. Neurogenic, that was one of our, was it one of our? Disruption to the central nervous system, spastic bladder, trauma, spinal cord injury victims. Okay, you're going to have neurogenic bladder. Talked about incontinence. We went through all these words, right? Mixed incontinence would be obviously several different kinds. Overflow, you can figure out what that is. Functional, just doesn't function. Could be many of the detailed ones that we discussed. It can be congenital. It can be acquired and often is reversible. That's the key. This is a really good place for nurses to have some impact on your patient. Often incontinence is reversible, which is pretty great. Manifestations of urinary tract disorders. You're going to see nocturia, incontinence, obviously. Sometimes we get some dementia, actually, from UTIs. Often UTIs, they have this, they're saying something's not right. Something's not feeling good. More than half the time it's a UTI. They just have a sensation that they're getting sick. Send the urine for analysis. Half the time it's going to come back, but that's the problem. We've caught it nice and early. So I can't tell you how many times people said, oh, it's just... And I said, well, your body's not showing anything. I can't see anything yet. And the urine's still clear. But, you know, another 12 hours, it's cloudy. So, and there's no fever, and there's... So this kind of not feeling right is very common. And, of course, eventually there's a fever, and you have all the signs of infection. Of course, we talked about catheters, and they can be associated with UTIs. And we talked about acute pyelonephritis, okay, calculi, renal calculi, all about that. Hematuria, blood in the urine, abdominal pain, flank pain, okay, hydronephrosis, when the kidney is inflamed. A little bit about urinary tract tumors. Urinary retention, talked about that, talked about urinary, all this. What are we going to do? Talked about what we're going to do, right? We're going to take care of our patients. We're going to see what kind of antibiotics we're on. We don't want them on antibiotics longer than 7 to 10 days, do we? There are good flora living in our urinary tract. We want to keep them there. We don't just simply want to kill off everything. Urinary tract infections are extremely common with antibiotic treatment. So be aware of that. Cultures. Talk about renal calculi. Talk about tumors. Neurogenic bladder. What we do. Basic surgical procedures. We can remove or destroy the calculi. That's kind of interesting. They do surgery to remove the calculi, which is interesting. I remember last semester there was a 9-year-old woman and we opted not to remove the calculi and tried to give her all sorts of treatments to break them up because we didn't think she could withstand surgery. So a lot of the decisions on how to treat this kind of thing have to do with the age of the patient and where they are. We talked about urinary calculus and we look at them. It's pretty cool. And actually, yeah.
My friend is 7 months pregnant and she's having a really hard time with
Yeah, they go in and take the stones out. and they can do it laparoscopically.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So it's not going to be too bad if she has to have it done. Okay. Don't worry too much about it. Okay. But, yeah, I hope she doesn't. That's horrible. But she probably can't take a lot of the medications, too.
No, she can't.
Right. And the procedures. Okay. I can certainly go through this. I'm anxious to get on to the next. We talked about pretty much all that. I'm anxious to start talking about upper GI urinary bowel problems. So we talked about the nurse being in charge of urine. Well, guess what? We also get to do bowel. Isn't that fun? And what are we going to learn from bowels? Yeah, if there's any GI bleed, yes, absolutely. What else? What else can we see? What are we going to tell from bowels? Looking at feces. Hydration, excellent. Yeah. If someone's defecating little tiny stones, what's that telling you? They're severely dehydrated. And they have to really push down, and there's a lot of pressure. Yes. Blood, you can tell hydration status. What else? Nutrition, how so? Good point. If they're having trouble going to the bathroom, possibly not enough fiber. Because what does fiber do? How does that physiologically work in the bowel? Pardon me? The fibers don't break down, correct. Therefore, what do they do to increase motility? They bulk up stool, yeah. And how does that increase motility?
Isn't it like stimulates the muscle and
peristalsis? That's exactly it. If we have fiber, it's going to push against the sides of the intestine, thereby causing peristalsis. Okay, so then the peristalsis will continue to move everything down. If we don't have enough fiber to push against the side, you can get some stasis. You get enough of that, and you have a block, right? Which is what we don't want. But yes, we want the fiber so it can push against. And it's kind of counterintuitive at times. You don't want the fiber to block it up. It's not going to. It's going to push against the side, then letting the peristalsis work. But unfortunately, in your anatomy class or your physio class, you probably didn't cut open a rabbit, did you? I had the most fascinating physio class, I'll never forget it, years and years and years ago, at San Francisco State. And we sacrificed this beautiful white rabbit to look at peristalsis. And I tell you, it was so worth that rabbit's life for all of us to see it, because to actually watch peristalsis is amazing. I mean, we actually got to see it, you know, see, and it's just like a snake. It's so cool. And to visual, if you ever go into surgery and get to see it, it's just you probably wouldn't, because it would be an exercise, you wouldn't be going. But it's fascinating just to see how the body, just moves it on down. And it's that pressure, exactly, against that causes the peristalsis. So if you have no pressure, it's going to be here, and you're not going to get the movement. So certainly diet is important. So we look at stool, right? That is important. Diarrhea. Aren't we talking about fun things today? Diarrhea is an increase in the frequency, volume, and or fluid content in stool. You don't have to have all these to have diarrhea. If you have frequent stool and they're still fairly well formed, that's still considered diarrhea. If you have huge volumes, it's still considered diarrhea. So diarrhea is a very far-reaching term. Most commonly, it's used for watery stool, right? And that will be one of your descriptions. Again, when you're talking about stool, you get to describe it all sorts of ways, right? What are you going to describe? Color? Consistency?
Yeah.
Is it mushy? Is it well-formed? And what's the other thing you're going to describe? Color, consistency, and? Odor? Good. What else? If you see anything. Golf ball. Blood, yeah. What else? Pardon me? Amount, volume. Very important. Volume is huge. Okay? And yes, you can certainly get an idea of someone's nutritional status, right? Big fat people who eat a lot have a lot of stool. They keep going through. Someone who's eating more efficiently, using all their nutrients, they have less stool. So it's very much a gauge of yeah, nutrition. Absolutely. All right. So what do we do for... Oh, let's take it. I'll try to follow this a little better. Constipation. The converse of diarrhea, we have constipation. Infrequency or difficult passage of stool. So what does this look like? Dehydration is a cause... Pardon me? Could lead to impaction, sure. Decreased mobility could certainly be a contributing factor to constipation. I'm sorry, pain, yeah. Cramping. Hypoactive bowel, yeah, sure. Any kind of like surgery, for instance, that would, yeah. Lethargic, lethargy. Pathology, yeah. We could have some kind of pathology that's causing. Right? So constipation is something important. You're missing one important... medication. Pardon me? Seneca. That's a stool softener. That's not going to cause constipation. What is the leading... what's it called? Problem with giving stool softeners? What do they say? Every time you write down Sena or something, what is the main problem that people have when they take stool softeners? Mm-hmm. Giving a big diarrhea. Yeah. So please be very careful. I know in general, every single patient's on the stool softener. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Are there that many people that are constipated? Why do we put every single patient, I swear, every patient on a stool softener? Medication, yeah. What else?
Mobility.
Right. And constipation certainly can be a result of lack of hydration. And hopefully in the hospital we're watching the hydration status and people are dehydrated. So yeah, a lot going on with stool. Okay, and again, we watch stool. Have you seen the hats in the toilet? We learned about those over the summer, hats. So we can take a look at feces and see what they look like and do all these assessments. Okay, color, volume, texture, okay, blood, do a hemocult, very important. Irritable bowel syndrome, let's talk a little bit about this. It's a spastic bowel or mucosa colitis. Okay. It's a chronic disorder of the GI tract with no identifiable organic cause. You see all the commercials for IBS now, right? Apparently extremely common. Characterized by abdominal pain, bloating with constipation, diarrhea, and both. What these patients often do is go back and forth between diarrhea and constipation. So one day they may have constipation, the other they may have diarrhea with no identifiable cause. And it's based on presentation, the diagnosis. So people generally present with pain, which is relieved by defecation, the change in stool formation, the change in bowel habits. Management involves relieving the manifestations and eliminating precipitating factors, but basically it's pretty hard to cure it all because we don't know what causes it. People say stress, whatever. Most common in women, you're supposed to outgrow it by the time you're 50. Very common. So, and we're not real sure why, but irritable bowel syndrome is extremely common. So fecal incontinence is a loss of voluntary control over defecation. It's considered a symptom, okay, not a disease. So... it's multi-factor. It could be caused by many, many different things. The common cause of fecal incontinence are those that interfere with either sensory or motor control of the rectum. Right? And the sphincters. It's certainly age-related. Like every other muscle in our body that ages, our sphincter muscles age, and elderly people do not have the same control or the ability to control their bowels, as you're learning in Jero, as do younger people. All the sphincters are starting to give out, all the muscles are giving out, so fecal incontinence is not uncommon. Age-related changes to anal sphincter in response to rectal distension increases the risk for older adults. It's diagnosed on patient history, examination of the pelvic floor, and anus to evaluate muscle tone. That's how it's diagnosed. Has anybody seen a rectal tube yet? In the hospital, we have rectal tubes. It's commonly what we can use to aid in fecal incontinence. Why might we resort to a rectal tube? That sounds awful. Why would we do that to someone? Yeah. Feces. Absolutely. It's when the risk of the skin breakdown really outweighs the negatives to having a rectal tube. When people have a rectal tube, we keep the contents real soft. We keep them on a lot of stool softeners, not necessarily watery, but close to it. And they're usually a good inch in diameter. Okay, they're inserted in the rectum, and the same kind of balloon idea is there, holds it into the rectum. And it's about that wide, but it also flattens out. So it just, as stools ruin through it, it goes like this. And it goes to a bag, very similar to a Foley. So keep your eyes out for rectal tubes. Anyone who's ever been involved in a violent code brown and has spent an entire shift cleaning up stool will be a proponent of rectal tubes, even though they sound absolutely awful. The amount of nursing time that it can take if a patient's having this kind of problem is just immense. And hopefully you'll all have a code brown this semester and get some feeling for that. Why do we have sometimes this absolutely horrible diarrhea? Why do you think? Yeah, it could be some pathology. Unfortunately, a lot of it is nursing. Nurses cause it. Your patients you're very concerned about constipation. They haven't voided in 5 days. You start giving them some medication. The nurse following you, they still haven't defecated. They're looking, they don't look back on the chart, it's the next day, they don't look back on the old MARD, they give them some more. Okay, 2 days down the road, the third nurse spends her entire shift cleaning up stool. Because, yeah, they may have been a little constipated. Now, oh my goodness, okay? Normally, in that case, we don't insert a rectal tube. We just spend the day cleaning them up because we know there's not a pathology that's involved. But when people have completely lost any use of the musculature, a neurological problem, or simply age-related, yeah, it's a good way to go because skin breakdown can be horrible from stool. And sometimes it can happen extremely quickly. As you're learning about your general population, the skin is so fragile that an hour sitting in stool can cause immense breakdown. So it's a real, real problem for nurses. Anyway. Let's move on. That was fecal incontinence. Now let's talk a little bit about appendicitis. It's an inflammation of the appendix, commonly causing acute abdominal pain. And that depends on the stage of inflammation. It can be classified as simple, inflamed but still intact. If the infection gets to the point where the appendix becomes gangrenous, okay, areas of the appendix no longer have an oxygen supply and they start to die off, that can be extremely serious. Also, sometimes the appendix is perforated and you have the bacteria from the infected appendix going into the abdominal cavities. Both those are extreme emergencies. So the goal is to catch the problem when it's still at the pain stage. Before it progresses either to a gangrenous appendix, when the bacteria is just destroying everything, or even worse, when it's perforated and then leaking out into the intestinal cavity. I mean, the abdominal cavity, because you can imagine what problems that can cause. Manifestations of acute appendicitis include continual, mild, generalized upper abdominal pain. So normally the course of manifestations are, over the next 4 hours, the pain intensifies, localizes to the right lower quadrant. Right. Now that's aggravated by moving, which makes sense. So if a person moves, walks, coughs, the pain increases. If they stay still, it's not quite so bad. Now we start seeing a low-grade temp, usually anorexia. Now remember what that means, right? Just not wanting to eat, no appetite. Nausea, vomiting, often. Possible complications, as we said, can include abscess and when it's perforated. An acutely inflamed appendix can perforate within 24 hours after the infection starts. So it's not something you mess around with. Once diagnosed, they perform an appendectomy. Pretty straightforward. And often there's limited time.
Okay.
So there you go. The address we use it for localized size. This is where often we feel pain. This is Mercurius Point, located midway between the umbilicus and the anterior neck crest in the white lower quadrant, and it's a usual site for localized pain and rebound tenderness due to appendicitis. That's where you're going to be able to push and feel pain. Peritonitis. What's peritonitis? Simply an inflammation of the peritoneum, right? From all sorts of sources. It's a serious complication of many abdominal disorders. It can be caused by a chemical irritant, bacteria entering the peritoneal cavity. Right, it's all important. Ruptured gallbladder, ruptured appendix, okay. Perforated diverticulum, for instance, perforated intestine, necrotic bowel, lots of different things. And the manifestations depend on the severity. And again, you're going to eventually get some fever. The abdomen is tender, guarding. Okay. This is the kind of thing you're going to look for after abdominal surgery. If the abdomen is open, say someone has a resection of the bowel, when you resect a bowel, you cut into the bowel. What happens to everything that's in the bowel? It has a chance of getting to peritoneum, doesn't it? Granted, they lavage the entire peritoneum with antibiotics, but still there's a risk for infection. So particularly people with abdominal surgery, this is something you really want to watch for, peritonitis. We give antibiotics after surgery to prevent this, but not always does that work. Sometimes it leads to septic shock. It can be extremely serious post-surgical complication. Gastroenteritis, inflammation of the stomach and small intestine. Not at all uncommon. Bacteria, parasites, viruses, toxins. Okay. And you've all had a little gastroenteritis, right? A little virus that gets in. Nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. Severity of manifestation is dependent upon the severity of the infection and the inflammation. And that, again, is going to depend on the virulence of the organism as well as the defense mechanisms of the person, right, the host. So we all know about that. What else do we have here? Protozoan bowel infections. Okay. Traveling up in the mountains, drinking unfiltered water. You might see some of these. Worms, not uncommon. Protozoans, and maybe dysentery. All very common. Let's talk a little bit about chronic inflammatory disorders. Hold on, let me get to that. Because you're going to see these for sure. Ulcerative colitis primarily affects the mucosa of the large bowel. Okay. Diarrhea is the most common manifestation. And this is where you're going to see blood in the stool. People are fatigued. They have anorexia. It can be a severe disease. It can go on to have all sorts of complications, hemorrhage. We can have a toxic megacolon, a colon perforation. These people are at higher risk for colon cancer with ulcerative colitis. Crohn's is a patchy involvement, all right? So you see a breakdown in the submucosal layers of any portion of the GI tract, even the mouth. Okay, so unlike ulcerative colitis, Crohn's can really be anywhere, a breakdown of the mucosa anywhere. Crohn's is thought to be an autoimmune disease, begins with small inflammation and then can get huge. Again, fever, fatigue, malaise, weight loss. The worst is a perforated colon. Generally, Crohn's victims, they have the disease forever. It's chronic. They keep getting sections of their GI tract removed, resected. It's really a tough life. Treatment is just to keep the bacterial count down. So oftentimes they're on steroids to suppress the inflammation. A lot of diarrhea, all sorts of problems with those. Here's the mucosa of the large intestine. Kind of cool. And these crypts are focal points for ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease. That's what it looks like. Little ulcerations into the submucosa. Pretty cool. Section showing problems. Crohn's. What's diverticulum? Do you have any ideas? Not fecal matter. But you're right. So what is it first? Outpouching. Right? So, little pouches in the intestine. Okay, it's usually higher, so it's not fecal matter. It's food. Okay, very, very common. Little outpouchings in the colon that occur in rows. Okay, so I guess, I don't know, I've never heard it described as fecal matter, but I suppose you're right. We think of beans and little seeds getting in, and so I'm thinking more food, but you're right, probably things are left over and not broken down. So sure, yeah, I guess it would be correct to say that. So little outpouchings in the colon that occur in little rows. These outpouchings then, and material collects in them, and then they become infected. Now you have diverticulitis. You can have peritonitis, abscess formation, bowel obstruction, fistula, hemorrhage. So diverticular disease, although very common, can be very, the complications can be very serious. So you'll see a lot of diagnoses of diverticulitis. Diverticula of the colon, where they are. Okay. These little outpouchings of the diverticula. And there are polyps. You've heard about colon polyps, right? That are removed. Sometimes they are precancerous, very often, or they're cancerous polyps. There's a nice example of one. Tubular polyp. Sometimes. Colorectal cancer, we've talked a little bit about that. Third most common cancer in the U.S., people over 50. Very common, polyps. Common. Colorectal cancer, we learned a little bit about that. There's an example of cancer distribution in the colon. 30% have rectal cancer, 20% is here. Okay. All the areas that are commonly seen. Right. Hernias. What's a hernia? Anybody had a hernia that they want to talk about? What's a hernia? It's simply a defect in the abdominal wall that allows the abdomen to protrude out of the cavity. Very simple. We have some examples. Abdominal wall hernias and an inguinal hernia. So here you have abdominal walls and inguinals. And we talked a little bit already about obstruction disorders. Talked about diarrhea and gangrene. What else? Oh, this is interesting. Yeah, the intestines can absolutely be twisted. Okay, that's volvulus. And we had a patient with that last semester. Very interesting. Okay. It's extremely dangerous, obviously. This is an incarcerated hernia. This is a tumor. Okay. This is when the intestine kind of comes back in on itself. Intestinception, whatever you want to say that. So these are all things that you may see in your patients. All right, what else? Medications, we give all sorts of them. We've talked about that. Talked a little bit about laxatives. Antiprotozoan, antifungals are out there. Inflammatory bowel, we talked about that. Talked about diarrhea, constipation. What else? Special diets. Removal of the colon. Yep, let's go back and look at that. Okay. Ileal pouch. Ileostomy, okay? Intestinal ostomy made out of the ileum, the small intestine. You may find ileostomies versus colostomies. They're higher. What's that? You all know what that is? Stoma. We learned about that this summer. So I know you're all up to that, and you know about the ileostomy. Well, that's pretty fun. Perianal surgeries. We got it, right? Yep. Thank you very much, and I know a couple of you have questions about other things that we need to discuss. Thank you for your attention. That was a heck of a lot of material. Yay, you did it.